This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. In early December, the Washington Department of Natural Resources released a long-awaited management plan for state forests that has at its heart a concern for sustainable harvests and a court-ordered conservation plan for the marbled murrelet, a tiny threatened seabird that relies upon large tracts of old-growth forest for successful breeding. Considering the DNR's concurrent and seemingly contradictory missions to conserve the forest for the likes of the murrelet and to maximize timber sale revenues to support schools and other tax districts, it is perhaps not surprising that lawsuits challenging the legality of the plan have this month been filed on both sides of the issue, with state trust lands revenue beneficiaries on the one hand arguing that the plan breaches the DNR's fiduciary responsibility to them by dramatically reducing revenues, while a consortium of environmental groups has filed a complaint that the plan does not go far enough to protect the public's interest in conserving the forest. In this week's Compass, we first reprise a story we did a little more than 6 years ago, when the marbled murrelet was at the center of another lawsuit against the DNR, and then we catch up with the fortunes of the murrelet in a follow-up phone interview with Maria Mudd Ruth, the author of a book about the bird who was one of those consulted in devising the controversial management plan. So, here's the Compass segment first aired on November 18, 2013. Acres of old-growth timber in southwest Washington have at least temporarily been spared the chainsaw after King County Superior Court Judge Bruce Heller agreed with the Sierra Club, the Audubon Society, and the Olympic Forest Coalition last month that the state's Department of Natural Resources plan to log the trees failed to take into account commitments it had previously made to conserve the vanishing habitat of a shy and retiring seabird the size of a robin. The marbled murrelet spends most of its life diving for herring and other small fish far offshore, never touching foot to land, until it comes time to breed. But when that time comes, the murrelet heads far inland, where it lays just one single egg annually in the moss of a wide branch high up in an old-growth tree, a dependency which has made the endangered bird second only to the spotted owl as a safeguard of the tiny remaining percentage of the ancient forest against the onslaught of the chainsaw and the intense international demand for the last of the old timber. To celebrate the victory on behalf of the reclusive seabird, the local chapters of the three environmental organizations that brought the suit invited Maria Mudd Ruth, author of a book titled Rare Bird, about the murrelet, to speak in Port Townsend. I spoke with the author shortly before her talk to a jam-packed cotton building audience began. What got you on to the marbled murrelet?
I met the marbled murrelet on the internet in 1999. I was living in Virginia, researching a children's book on the Pacific Coast, and came across this very strange little seabird that I had never heard of, whose name I couldn't pronounce. And when I discovered that it was endangered, that it nested up to 37 miles inland, that it laid one egg in the old-growth forest, this is a seabird we're talking, that it took 185 years to find its nest. And I thought, how could it take anyone that long to find a bird nest? And I started trying to figure out what happened 185 years before the first nest discovery, which was in 1974. So I started back in 1789 and then went further back from there and then brought the story of this bird and its biology and its behavior and the mystery surrounding the location of its nest, the scientists studying this bird, the ramifications for the world when a bird is found in an old-growth forest.
It must be kind of rare for a seabird to nest only in old-growth forests.
We're talking about a bird the size of a robin, flying nonstop direct from the water all the way inland to a nest branch and making a stall-out landing on a branch. These are really the larger platforms where a bird could make a landing like this. There we're talking 1 and 2 foot wide branches in the tops of mature and old growth trees. And these are the only trees, the Doug firs, the redwoods, western hemlock, western red cedar, Sitka spruce, Alaska yellow cedar. These are the trees that are large enough to hold branches like this and make a place for a marbled murrelet.
Well, now, why does a robin-sized bird need a great big huge old tree? I mean, why not just some twiggy little like second growth tree? Why wouldn't they do?
Right. Well, a couple things. One is that it's a web-footed bird. It doesn't perch the way a perching bird would. So it has to have a platform, a wide platform. The family of birds, the alcids, nest on rocky outcrops, flatter places. This is the family of birds. This is how they nest. They're not perching birds, and they don't nest in smaller trees. Northern spotted owls will nest in smaller trees, but the murrelet is specific to these large platforms that the mature and old growth forests provides. And in Alaska, they do nest on the ground and in crevices. That is known, but where there are trees available for them, that's their preferred habitat for nesting.
Now, the marbled murrelet, like the spotted owl, has come of a tool that environmentalists have started using in order to preserve old-growth forest.
There are struggles happening throughout marbled murrelet breeding range. And yeah, the Olympic Peninsula is the hotspot for marbled murrelet habitat in Washington State. The Zone 1 of the Washington State, San Juan Islands and Straits of Juan de Fuca are where most of the birds are in Washington State. So every piece of forest is contested, if not now, then very shortly. And this is very challenging for environmental groups. This is a constant battle to preserve and protect old growth forests and also to allow younger forests to grow into the mature old growth habitat that the birds need. So this tonight's talk that I'm giving is part of a sort of a celebration of a recent victory in the courts to protect 12,000 acres of marbled murrelet habitat in Southwest Washington that the Department of Natural Resources is planning to log without a long-term conservation strategy. So that was a major court victory. The judge decided that the Department of Natural Resources had to have a long-term conservation strategy, not a temporary one, which is what they've been operating under since 1997.
So now, if these birds are breeding like 37 miles, as you say, inland, how do they train their young to become seabirds?
As far as I know, there is no training at all. This bird fledges on instinct. The story of the fledging of a marbled murrelet is one of the most marvelous stories. It does not follow its parents from the nest. The parents are not nearby cajoling it. The chick steps to the edge of the nest at sunset and takes off. It's never flown before. It does not know where the ocean is. It has not seen the ocean. It has not taken practice flights. And it makes its way west, possibly in the direction its parents might have been coming from when they brought food in. This is a flight that is made on instinct. And when you're talking about a bird flying by.
So they fledge and they head out to sea and immediately know how to fish and to fend for themselves?
A biologist in Washington State named Tom Hamer had a bird that he finished raising in his spare bedroom. It was a foundling bird. And he took it out to the water after it attempted to fledge into his closet by going west every night at sunset. Tom said, I've got to get this bird out of here. Took the bird out on the boat, took him into the water, and he said within minutes the bird was swimming and diving like a seabird.
What is their range? I mean, where do they exist?
They range from the Aleutian Islands into South Central California.
So now I imagine there must be other challenges facing these birds.
So they're threatened throughout that area, mostly by logging, and has always been the number one threat to this bird. We've removed 80 to 95% of its old growth and mature habitat. Oil spills, chronic oil pollution. It's a small bird, quickly covered in oil, becomes hypothermic and drowns before it can ever make it to shore to be rescued. The depletion of its prey species, the forage fish, herring, sand lance, capelin, surf smelt, a whole number of fish, anchovies, and this is a worldwide crisis actually, but this is the fish the murrelet feeds on. And the destruction of shoreline habitat, which takes out any spawning grounds of these fish impacts the marble murrelet. There's a host of threats. Gill netting is a major threat. Murrelets get pulled in as bycatch. British Columbia takes in about 1,000 birds a year. Where the birds are most populous, which is Alaska and British Columbia, it is still legal and it's still a major problem for the marble murrelet. One of the biggest threats is predation at the nest by corvids, and this is a family of very intelligent birds that includes common ravens and Steller's jays and American crows. And what's happened is in our fragmented landscape, these birds, which are not normally edge predators, move into the edge of the forest where they begin to hunt for food, and then they work their way closer and closer into the marble murrelet territory. Once they find a marble murrelet egg and chick, which makes a very easy meal, they then learn to search the forest for marble murrelet eggs and chicks. These birds are large enough and aggressive enough to knock an adult murrelet off the nest and take the egg and chick. And this has become a major problem, not only in fragmented landscapes, but also in our protected areas, state parks, national parks, other public recreation lands, where there is a close proximity of human beings and trash and campgrounds and marble murrelets and crows and ravens and jays. So what happens is, people bring in food for camping, and they either feed a bird directly because it's very gratifying to feed wildlife, or they leave food behind, or perhaps the trash isn't covered very well at the campsite, and more animals begin to feed off of the trash that we've left behind. So what I'm proposing as a grassroots citizen science project is to get on top of the nest predation issue by working with state parks to have volunteers go into a state park near where they live and survey the campgrounds. Find out what kind of trash cans they have, what kind of dumpsters they have, are there holes chewed in them, are there lids on them, is there any signage at the kiosks saying, please don't feed the corvids, there are endangered species living in this area or near this area. Once you reduce the food supply, then hopefully the ravens and jays will not continue to come into the state parks looking for food. They will learn that there is more food elsewhere.
So what's the best estimate of the current population of murrelets?
Around 350,000, which is a third of what it was when I wrote the book back in 2005 in hardback.
So two-thirds have vanished just in like 8 years or something?
Yeah. When I wrote Rare Bird in 2005, it was nearly a million birds. Between 2001 and 2010, there was about a 29% decline in California, Washington, and Oregon, where the bird is federally listed as threatened. So it's you can do the math. It doesn't take long to get to zero.
This is Steve Evans for KPTZ Community Radio News. The preceding interview with Rare Bird author Maria Mudd Ruth took place in November of 2013. I telephoned her for this follow-up interview last week.
Now that this plan is finally out, I thought I'd call you up and find out, first of all, how the bird has fared over the last 6 years since we last spoke.
The marble murrelet is not doing well. In Washington state, the declines are about 4.4%. a year. So between 2001 and 2016, we lost 44% of our marble murrelets in Washington. In Oregon and California, there was a slight increase in bird populations there, and it's possible birds are shifting ranges where there is more suitable habitat, where there is a more stable supply of the small fish that they feed on, but we don't know, and that makes everything very confusing to make policy and strategies when you don't really understand what the birds are doing, how they're behaving, what pressures they're responding to in the environment. But overall, the bird is not faring well, and it's primarily because of the continued loss of its nesting habitat, these older, mature coastal forests.
How are the censuses taken? I mean, is it like the Christmas bird count? Or, I mean, what's the main method for counting the population?
Great question. Yeah, it would be wonderful if something like a Christmas bird count would work for the marble murrelet. I'm afraid it does not. And this is a job that is done by trained, skilled marine biologists and scientists who survey the bird at sea in the winter, in the summer, in the season where they are coming closer to the shore to nest inland. But you can't track these birds in the forest very well to do any kind of population count. So what they do is they have small boats, and they basically divide the coast up into transects and drive their boat back and forth and back and forth and count birds on either side of a boat moving up and down these transects. And if you can imagine being on a boat bobbing along in the waves with a pair of binoculars trying to count robin-sized seabirds that are diving below the boat, you can imagine the kind of challenge required to count these birds accurately. So it's the estimates have a high level of sort of uncertainty, I guess. But it's the only way to count these birds. It does make it very difficult. Most other seabirds can be counted more easily by sort of flying over their nesting areas on the coast, or because they flock in large groups, you can estimate populations that way. But marble murrelets don't really flock in large groups on the water in the lower 48 states. So it makes it extremely challenging.
But nonetheless, I guess over time, you can see trends. I mean, you would assume that, you're kind of catching the same percentage of the population each time you go out and do the transects. So I'd like to go back to... a little bit about the conservation plan. So we know that Washington finally came out with a conservation plan, which is already under attack from various taxing authorities and so on, who feel that basically the Department of Natural Resources is failing in its management of state trust lands, which are supposed to be for the benefit of schools and various other like taxing districts. And they're challenging it on one hand, and then on the other hand, we have the Washington Environmental Council and a couple of other environmental groups are saying that the DNR has done a very poor job of stewarding these state lands, which are supposed to be for the benefit of all the public. And I just wonder what you've heard. I mean, you know, what the scientists you talk to, the specialists in the marble murrelet, feel about the Washington plan?
To be honest, I have not talked with any marble murrelet scientists about the plan since it was released in December. Scientists tend to not weigh in on plans. They provide data and special expertise during some of the meetings, but generally they do not weigh in on plans like this. They provide the data and try to retain their scientific objectivity. What I can say is, after sitting in on monthly meetings of the Board of Natural Resources since 2012, when all these groups that you mentioned, the Environmental Coalition, which I'm a part of as a representative of the Audubon chapters in Washington State, the environmental law firms, the conservation groups, as well as the representatives of the various counties that will be impacted, and the timber industry, and the people who are running the mills and having the logging jobs. All these people have been in the room having conversations about this plan and working really hard to come up with a win-win-win for timber industry, for the beneficiaries, for the marble murrelet. And it has been, I would say, really tough going to find a solution here. So the plan, I never got the feeling that we were going to come up with a win-win-win. It's just a very difficult, almost intractable problem to harvest this very same habitat you are trying to save. So I don't quite know how the DNR is going to get out of this one. all the concerns of the counties and the conservation groups about the strategy that was chosen, I would say, are legitimate. There are flaws with this strategy. There are some excellent benefits of this strategy, but the idea that we can, with this strategy, make everyone happy, save the murrelet, bring revenue to the counties and the trust beneficiaries, which include, you know, things that we benefit from. And we, you know, we talk about it sort of, it's like it's them, but, you know, we benefit from revenue to our firefighting districts, to our libraries, to our school construction, to our public universities. My kids went to public school. They had new buildings, new wings of buildings in classrooms that they enjoyed. They went to public university. I am personally the beneficiary of this timber revenue. So I understand the complaints when what happens is all of a sudden that revenue isn't coming in. So a lot of the counties have legitimate complaints about it. But interestingly, it's less about the marbled murrelet, which was part of the long-term conservation strategy, than it is about another plan that was developed in parallel with that, which is called the sustainable harvest calculation. And this is a wonky term for the way the state estimates how much timber it has to harvest to provide the beneficiaries with what they need and what they can take off the landscape and still be in compliance with many rules, including those of the Endangered Species Act that protects marbled murrelets. So it's that plan, the sustainable harvest calculation plan, that I think really caught people by surprise, because what it did was announce very late in the year that many of the trust beneficiaries, the school districts, would have much less revenue than they depended on, because the harvest was reduced to the point where their budgets would be impacted negatively. So that has upset a lot of people, and I completely understand that when you are planning out your budget for your classrooms, your mobile classrooms, your school construction, and all of a sudden you've lost, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in revenue. That really puts those districts at a disadvantage. And so there's a lot of non-Murrelet related frustration right now with the Department of Natural Resources.
It sounds to me like the Department of Natural Resources is actually in the position of the messenger who's delivering a hard message to hear, which is that basically we cannot continue to take the amount of timber out of the forest each year sustainably, and therefore funding must come from somewhere else.
Absolutely. And I was impressed during the last meeting of the Board of Natural Resources when each of the board members spoke before they cast their vote on this. And our superintendent of public schools for Washington, Chris Rakedahl, sits on the Board of Natural Resources and gave a very impassioned speech stating that the $80 to $90 million that the K-12 gets in for school construction is pennies of their $3.5 billion annual budget. And he strongly stated that we need to phase off using timber as the revenue source for this, that other monies have to get to counties and to the industries that are impacted by the long-term conservation strategy, and that this money needs to go ultimately to protecting habitat and species and not to the school construction budget. So this is big, and a lot of people in the room were in agreement with that, but how to get there is the big problem. Clearly the DNR simply can't stop logging right away, but moving this somehow through the legislature in Washington to shift the revenue going to our schools and beneficiaries away from timber seems to me to be the way to sustainably harvest. It's really absurd to think that you can continue to harvest at the levels that you are harvesting and be considered sustainable. Yes, they are replanting, but those small trees never get to be the status of the old growth mature forest that we know the murrelets rely on. the long-term conservation strategy does protect key areas of high-quality old-growth habitat for the murrelet, but they also release a lot of that for logging. So it's
a lot of it?
Kind of a, yes, a lot of it. And so the idea is that they would, over time, save, protect the older forest and protect younger forests around it in these large blocks of habitat so that the younger forests can mature into suitable nesting habitat for the marble murrelet. And we're talking, this conservation plan is a 50-year plan. So we're thinking, well, in 50 years, will we develop the kind of structure in the forest that the murrelets need for nesting, these nice wide platforms that they make their nest on? That's the hope. Of course, now climate change and the impact of increased drought, increased fire, wildfire intensity and duration, all of that is, you know, has been calculated into this conservation plan, but it's still a lot of guesswork knowing how our forests are going to survive the next 50 years and what our landscape, how our landscape is going to change, not only under this new conservation strategy, but with all these other environmental factors that are causing, you know, the loss of forests that we've not seen before.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, in recent years, we've seen things that I don't think anybody ever expected to see in their lifetime, including, you know, much of British Columbia being on fire. I mean, you know the skies were orange and smoky in Port Townsend from fires that were far away in rainforest. So, yes, there definitely are new threats.
Yeah, and all these threats did, you know, the long-term conservation strategy, the real push to develop it started in 2012. And in just the last, you know, 7-8 years, lots of new data is coming out about climate change. And I'm not sure that was really considered in this plan. It seemed to be all new and new data coming in and just was not really part of the picture here. So that is a concern of mine about this strategy, is that climate change wasn't really given the consideration that I think it should have gotten.
If people want to contact you for any reason, is there a good way to do that?
Sure. I have a website and a contact form through that, and that website is mariaruthbooks.net. They can contact me through that and learn lots about the marble murrelet at the same time.
Okay, thank you so much.
You are welcome.
With rare bird author Maria Mudd Ruth, this is Steve Evans for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The first segment was originally broadcast on November 18, 2013. The Compass airs Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. and repeats the following Saturday at noon. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.